My name is Sunny Miller. We're interviewing tonight C. William Michaels, an attorney and writer in Baltimore. He's the author of No Greater Threat, America After September 11th and the Rise of a National Security State. Thank you so much, Chuck, for joining us, for driving up here to Deerfield while you're in New England. This is such an important topic as we prepare for a conference at Greenfield Community College on July 25th and 26th. Your book is a great analysis of the Patriot Act, a very dense volume. What did you find as you began to look at the technical language of Patriot Act 1?
I found that it is really a quite a comprehensive statute, probably more so than might first appear, even among people who've been talking a lot about it. Most of the concerns that have been raised about the Patriot Act to date generally focus on only two, maybe three titles of the statute, but the statute has 10 titles. And when I sat down really and read the thing cover to cover as soon as became available, the full text of the statute in the law libraries, I was just very taken by the sweep of it, the scope of it, and the detail of it. There are sections of the statute that are quite complex and get very, very little attention, but are at least as sources of concern as the ones that people talk about.
Can you name the three that people talk about most and then just give us a sure. bit from the ones that are lesser known?
The ones that are mostly discussed are the search and seizure and intelligence capabilities and provisions. It's mostly Title II of the Patriot Act. The immigrant and detention and designation of terrorist groups powers, and that is mostly Title IV of the Patriot Act. And then I would say, some extent, there has been some talk about this new crime of domestic terrorism and some of those other things. That's found in Title VIII of the Patriot Act, but there are many other provisions.
Now, I understand the Title VIII measure allows for someone who is simply protesting an illegal action of government by sitting in front of a tank or a vehicle of some kind could be charged with very serious crimes and even labeled a terrorist by law. Can you explain to me how a nonviolent, quiet, and civil action could be so grossly overinterpreted?
Well, I think the concerns that have been raised about this new crime of domestic terrorism that's in Title VIII of the Patriot Act, also covering regular standard protest activity, is kind of a stretch. There's the definition of domestic terrorism has as its several components, but the first component is an act that's dangerous to human life. So, you know, picketing in front of a government building or handing out leaflets somewhere or even a march down the street if there's been a permit issued or, a variety of other things that you can imagine, even certain aspects of civil disobedience, like a sit-in, for example, wouldn't necessarily be an act dangerous to human life. There are, instances, if you get creative enough, where you could come up with a civil disobedience or protest action that might fit all of the requirements of domestic terrorism. But so far, no one has been charged under this statute. So it would really be up to, the test of time to see how far this is going to be taken by the government.
Which measures of the act, which titles are not being discussed?
Well, there's a very extensive and probably the most extensive title of the Patriot Act called Title III, having to do with federal banking laws and investigation of terrorist financing and money laundering, which is taken in large extent from the same kind of principles that you apply in the war on drugs. And that is a quite complex part of the Patriot Act. It allows Treasury agents to impose special information orders upon banks. It allows for, wide investigation of banking transactions of all kinds in all areas. And also allows for a new bureau in the division, in the Bureau of the Treasury, in the Department of the Treasury, called the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, which not too many people are talking about. So that's one aspect. Another is Title V, which expands the DNA data bank for people who are convicted of terrorist crimes and does a variety of other things that a lot of people don't talk about. There's a Title VII, which is only one section, but it establishes a new program for infrastructure protection, which a lot of people are not talking about. There is a...
Well, tell us why you're concerned about Title VII.
Well, this whole theme of infrastructure protection is simply another area of government involvement in the war on terrorism that doesn't get a lot of debate. And the whole approach of Patriot Act and certainly the Homeland Security Act is this new wave of interest in developing anti-terror plans and new security measures and, you know, worst-case scenario, strategies for all areas of our infrastructure. And 85% of our national infrastructure is in private hands. So this is going to be a very interesting private-public kind of new, level of involvement between these, great areas of our economy.
Could you explain that a little better? I don't quite catch. You said 80% of the infrastructure protection services?
No. 85% of the infrastructure that exists in our country. If infrastructure, you're considering, communication systems, telephone networks, utilities, power plants, sanitation and water and sewer, highways, transportation. You know, a lot of that is government or quasi-government services, but an awful lot of it is also privately owned in companies or in utility firms or what have you. Mm-hmm. So if you consider that there's going to be new strategies and plans developed to try and protect all these areas of our infrastructure, I mean, you're talking about ports, train stations, bus stations, communication systems, you know, utilities, power plants, I mean, you name it, chemical plants. This is a huge commitment of the government. It's going to be a very long-range kind of expenditure, and no one really knows how these plans are going to be developed. Much of it is going to be either classified or not subject to Freedom of Information Act disclosure. So, and this is an area that just is not getting a lot of debate. That's on. Then that's the Title VII of the Patriot Act.
So Title VII sounds like a very expensive undertaking. If the entire public wealth and much of the private wealth needs protection from unknown suspects, it would seem that it would create a huge tax on all of our productivity.
Sure.
So rather than, you know, the public being having a common wealth, we suddenly come to have a common burden. Mm-hmm. What remedies do you see for this overall thinking, this pattern of thought, which will also turn the public from being the directors of government, the power holders who vote people in and vote people out? I'm guessing that our new role and identity in the eyes of government will change to those will be seen as suspects rather than appropriate controllers of government. What's the remedy?
Well, and by the way, just to finish that thought, you were talking about unknown suspects, and I guess these plans have to be developed to address unknown suspects doing unknown things at unknown times with unknown weapons for unknown reasons, you know. I mean, it's impossible you can enhance a security system and security methods. I mean, there are ways of doing that. There's a whole school of thought about that. But to try to prepare for every single conceivable contingency and to, you know, put funding into that kind of planning and response and sort of strategizing is going to be phenomenal. If you're talking about the entire scope of our infrastructure, and even if you expand the definition to include, for example, our healthcare system, then you're talking about all the hospitals in the country. It's just amazing to consider the long range commitment that this is going to take. What is the remedy for that? I think the remedy, first of all, is to be thinking about the war on terrorism in different terms. You know, I mean, I think we have to begin to not just think about the who and the what and the when of terrorism, but also the why of terrorism and the overall policy issues that have to be addressed in order for us to get a much better understanding of the terrorist, you know, mindset. I mean, to think that these folks are simply maniacs who are bent on murder and mass destruction for no apparent reason, because they've got a screw loose. I mean, there are, you know, perhaps a few of those folks running around, but that is not what drives a terrorist to commit a terrorist act. Yeah.
So you're hoping that as a good teacher would try to understand why a student is very angry that mm-hmm. our government will represent us well and try mm-hmm. to figure out why various foreign nationals and even domestic groups are mm-hmm. very angry and mm-hmm. address those human needs and concerns mm-hmm. rather than spend an enormous wealth doing an impossible job. Mm-hmm. Let's go on to Patriot Act 2. Mm-hmm. This has been leaked, and can you tell mm-hmm. us a little bit about that, how that was leaked and what's happening as the leak? How is the leaking of this proposed Patriot Act 2 modified? Is the public more receptive? Are we less receptive? What's going on?
Patriot Act 2 is another name for a proposed statute called the Domestic Security Enhancement Act of 2003. And it was leaked, I think, in either late January or early February by someone in the Justice Department.
2003.
Right. Mm-hmm. And for reasons unknown, to a nonprofit group called the Center for Public Integrity, which is a very well-connected organization and was able to get attention to this statute as soon as it became available to the Now with Bill Moyers program. And Now with Bill Moyers did a segment on it in February of 2003 and actually put the statute, as well, the Center for Public Integrity did this as well, on their website, the full text of this proposed statute with the actual internal Department of Justice section-by-section analysis of the statute. So you were able to actually download both of those documents and read them. And then once that happened, well, of course, that became replicated throughout various sites on the Internet, and links were developed for all these other sites. So, I mean, pretty soon it spread like wildfire, and almost everybody was getting, you know, pieces or summaries or entire text of this proposed statute. It would go, it is not a law, it was not yet proposed to Congress, even as we speak, you know, for reasons that we could get into, perhaps.
We're speaking June 30th, 2003.
Right. And it would go considerably farther than the Patriot Act. Secret arrests, government ability to order autopsies in foreign countries of Americans who may be fatal victims of terrorism, potential forfeiture of American citizenship for people who are convicted of material support for terrorism, broad new forfeiture and intelligence provisions, a change to an exception in the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, for example, that would allow new forms of intelligence for a limited period of time without a court order in terms of emergency. Right now, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act reserves that extraordinary power for declaration of war by Congress. The Patriot Act 2 would change that to anytime Congress authorizes the use of military force, which means the resolution of the war in Iraq would have allowed for this kind of extraordinary, you know, search and investigative power without court supervision. I mean, it just goes on from there. I mentioned the DNA data bank that's expanded on the Patriot Act to where people convicted of terrorist crimes. The Patriot Act 2 would change that to people suspected of terrorist crimes.
So any human being without charge could be, their DNA could be sampled and taken against their will if this Patriot Act 2 were passed into law. Is that right? During any military action authorized by the president and however vaguely supported by Congress.
Well, that's a broad approach to it. I would say that probably the term suspected would have a little bit more specific definition as someone who has been either investigated or charged with some kind of terrorist crime, even though the prosecution might not proceed. If someone is suspected of a terrorist crime in some kind of legal process definition of that, then they'd have to, I would think, be under custodial interrogation or police detention or charges brought or something like that or an indictment. Mm-hmm. That would, however, still allow, even without formal prosecution and conviction, of DNA sampling from that person and that to be put under the DNA data bank under this proposed law. I mean, that doesn't exist right now.
Let's talk a little bit about the unexplained detentions without charge, mm-hmm. People who have been detained in Guantanamo mm-hmm. and many other places in the United States, no charges brought, no access to attorneys. Mm-hmm. Because information about people detained is not given to the public, mm-hmm. then I see little chance for oversight and little chance for court supervision in these mm-hmm. Sampling of DNA and such. Tell us about detentions. You've written in your book, may I read just one little passage about a detention? A former Boston cab driver, once identified by authorities as a major terrorism suspect, was kept in solitary confinement for more than 8 months in New York without seeing a judge or being assigned a lawyer. He was taken into custody on September 18th, 2001, but was not brought before a federal magistrate until May 22nd, 2002. That's 8 months in solitary confinement. The case has received attention as one of many violations of due process in the federal detention sweeps after September 11th. And in our previous chatting, you've said that the Bill of Rights does not apply to citizens. It applies to all persons. Mm-hmm. And plainly and clearly, these fundamental rights of due process have been terribly denied under Patriot Act 1. What are we giving enough attention to the stories of people who are detained right now?
Well, there's a lot in that question. What we're really talking about now is kind of like parallel, if not intersecting, kind of activity by the government. The Patriot Act under Title IV allows for detention of aliens who are suspected of terrorist crime to be held for 7 days without charge or trial. After those 7 days, they have to either be administratively charged, that is through the deportations process, or criminally charged, that is through the standard criminal process, or, you know, released. Or there is another route to be taken under Title IV that allows especially dangerous people to be held in administrative detention for up to 6 month periods if the government, you know, so certifies them. That's the Patriot Act itself. This other stuff you were talking about, like the cab driver, for example, the Guantanamo Bay folks, those detentions were not necessarily even under the Patriot Act. Those sweeps occurred almost immediately after September 11th. Patriot Act wasn't passed until the end of October. Mm-hmm. Although the sweeps were still continuing even after that time. So that was the government taking upon itself like a new level of executive power to hold people and simply detain them for whatever reasons whatsoever and to, you know, really kind of bend the rules, especially if they were aliens, of immigration authority to, you know, figure out how long these people could be held. That's part two of the answer. Part three of the answer is the Guantanamo Bay folks who are being detained, of course, in this detention camp. Camp Delta, I think it's called, in Cuba. Most of those, of course, are people who were captured in the Afghan war and other people who have been arrested around Europe and elsewhere since that time and then taken to this holding facility. And what's going to happen with those? Now, that's not under the Patriot Act either. That's under a different executive control. And the people are being called enemy combatants under a kind of exception to the POW rules of the Geneva Convention, that it gets very complicated. But in any event, the idea is these people can be held indefinitely without charge or trial. Federal courts have refused habeas corpus relief for these people. And there's even talk now that the government is going to set up maybe an execution chamber with military tribunals are being held on that site or maybe off-site in some sort of Navy ship floating around outside the Guantanamo Bay, and if the military tribunal, you know, votes for the death penalty, which it is able to do, then that death penalty could be carried out immediately because there is no appeal. Mm-hmm. So it's a whole new ballgame. So that's mm-hmm. part three of the answer. Part four of the answer is the enemy combatant label being used against U.S. citizens And two of those people are being held, Hande, who was arrested in Afghanistan, I believe, and then Padilla, the so-called dirty bomber. Both of those people are being held in Navy brigs. They're being held almost incommunicado with very little, if not no, contact with family members or attorneys, not being charged. And the government keeps saying that if we call these people enemy combatants, we can hold them until the war is over. Mm. Now, if that means the war on terrorism is over, then goodness knows how long these folks are going to be around. That's part four of the answer. Mm. Part five of the answer is that the courts have not done enough, I think, to really bring the full weight of the Constitution down upon this kind of executive action. In fact, quite to the contrary, we just had a decision from the Federal Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit that reversed a district court decision, and the appeals court said that the government does not have to release the names or any other information of any of these people who were detained, some of whom the government is still holding. Now, basically what that means is a piece of Patriot Act 2 is already in place, and that's secret arrests. Now, part six of the answer is what's happening. How can we bring more attention to bear on that? And I think that is absolutely critical. There's got to be much more public attention and concern brought to this kind of government activity. Because if it's allowed to continue, if the media, blesses it and the courts approve it and the public adopts it, then I think we're seeing a new wave of government action against citizens and aliens alike that's going to put us down a road that I don't think we want to be on.
Mm-hmm. Wow, you've raised so many issues here. In Massachusetts, we're facing terrible budget cuts for so many crucial programs, huge tuition increases at our universities, staff cutbacks. Last year and in the coming year, towns struggling to keep library hours what they have been. I believe the threat to close down interlibrary loan was stemmed last week. But how do we keep our attention focused on so many issues at once? We have our terrible programs being cut. These fundamental human rights being violated, dismantled. Will we be able to form coalitions that speak up? Who's doing the organizing that will support our interests in speaking up for human rights while we're so busy defending our economic functions of simple local government?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer, and it's also kind of doesn't bode well for people's ability to organize around some of these issues, which are very complex issues that we've been trying to explain. They're a very intractable issue. There's a very strong, trend here that we have to address. It was reminding me of a quote from Dan Berrigan, who says that we live in a society that is both seductive and destructive. In other words, people are being kind of lulled by a massive entertainment and broadcasting mega complex of all kinds and descriptions. I mean, far beyond anything that we knew, us baby boomers, knew as children, when it was three black and white TV channels where you had to change the channels by yourself and it all went off at midnight. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. those days are long gone. So we have all of that, and we have all the choices that are available, and then we have all the demands on our time, and we have kids to get to baseball practice, and we've got bills to pay. And on top of that, we're supposed to try and organize around issues that even experts in civil liberties are having, difficulty trying to explain to people how complex these things can be, even though fundamentally they're very simple issues that we're dealing with. Mm-hmm. But I mean, they may play out in a complex way. And then there's this whole new development in the economy that is causing a lot of anxiety and stress on people, unemployment rising, costs rising, budget cuts and so forth. Mm-hmm. And the answer to that is simply is I think that people need to try to get up every day and think about these issues. Get up every day and think about how we're going to respond and ways in which we respond. You cannot do everything all the time. Mm-hmm. You cannot work on every issue all the time. I think the peace movement is unfortunately too willing to ask of people that they, you know, put energy into every single issue that comes along. I don't think you can basically do that. I think that there are people who have concentrated on these issues. You have to figure out if there's an issue that you want to concentrate on.
Yeah.
I mean, none of the conversation we had has a thing to do about the environment. And there are issues in there that are of great concern to our short and long-term future as a human race, you know. Mm-hmm. There aren't going to be any civil liberties if we're not walking around.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously we need to look at all of this in a much more comprehensive way.
Mm-hmm.
And try and find ways to personally to respond. And I think that has to be an individual choice. As long as people realize that they need to come to that issue, address it somehow.
You are the co-founder of Pax Christi in Baltimore. Was that the local chapter?
Mm-hmm. That's right, the local chapter.
Yeah. Right. Do you find that in faith communities, people are able to discuss these important issues and get around to some action with the support of their friends and neighbors, Sunday mornings after church or at some other time?
Well, I think the faith community aspect is a crucial aspect of this debate. And one of my 12 characteristics of a national security state that I mentioned in my book, which is the main reason I wrote the book beyond just having a way to try to explain this massive Patriot Act to folks, is the response of the churches. If the state has the media and the judiciary and the churches behind it, there's very little it can't do. So I think the church's response to this issue is going to be a very pivotal concern over the next 3 to 4 years. My problem about that, however, is twofold. One is, I think, threefold. One is that a lot of faith communities, even well-intentioned, who are concerned about these things, have the same difficulties in organizing as any other group would have. I mean, the same demands on time, the same diversion of resources, the same fracturing of concerns and issues and attentions. So you have to try and find a way to focus even in those faith communities. That's the one part.
Mm-hmm.
The other part is, I think there are some marvelous statements that have come down from faith communities and religious organizations of all types and descriptions. But the problem is a lot of those statements, when the Patriot Act was passed or during the height of the Iraq War, never really got well disseminated to the congregational members. You know, Catholic Church statements of the United States Catholic Conference or Episcopal Church statements or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can name your denomination. A lot of major denominations and National Council of Churches issued some of these policy positions as we were going through this whole process.
Mm-hmm.
But not a lot of other folks were aware of that. So I think that's part of the real challenge, is to get those policy statements and those positions through to these congregations and let them address them and start to work with them.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third of the threefold answer is that there are some faith communities who, for reasons of their own, for their own interpretations of Scripture or whatever, have decided that that we're doing just fine, that there is no faith challenge, you know, to be discussed here. I happen to disagree with that, you know, in a major way, but I think it is part of the factor that we have to, take into account.
Oh, you mentioned the 12 points, the 12 measures of a national security state. Number 9 you've listed as national security mentality and a permanent war economy. Could you just speak briefly as we get ready to close here on how we are going to step outside this enormous level of spending, how to get back to sane spending priorities?
I'd love to talk about that. That's another whole hour conversation, and there are groups and people who have been working, you know, on that for many years. I think we basically have to start realizing that we will not fight our way out of this issue. This is not simply an issue to be thought of in strategic or tactical terms, that it's not simply a military question in and of itself. And I think we need to also realize that we're spending an awful lot of money on this. As someone told me, and I'd love to be corrected if this is wrong, but 50% of the discretionary budget in the federal system, 50% of the federal discretionary budget is spent on the military. Now, in any nation, that's got to be a subject of concern. I'm sure that level of military spending eclipses even other major nations' own spending on the military. And I think that really has to be looked at as a nation, because I don't think that is really bringing us to a resolution of the problems,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Thank you so much for all of your very specific knowledge and your broad humanitarian concern. We'll look for more of your wisdom at the conference, July 25th and 26th at Greenfield Community College. And again, Chuck Michaels' book, C. William Michaels, No Greater Threat, America After September 11th and the Rise of a National Security State.
And I want to say that that book is available through Barnes & Noble and Amazon.com, and there's also a website for the book if people want more information on it, or to contact me about it, and that's www.nogreaterthreat.com.
Thank you so much, and thanks to all our listeners who are taking time to write one little letter to the editor or make one phone call to their local media.
Every little bit helps. It's a pleasure. Thank you very much, Sonny.
This will be available to download on your computer, and it's available for broadcast by any radio station. So college radio stations everywhere are good candidates to air this material. You could, you know, help make that happen by calling your radio stations. Even commercial stations could air something this important, couldn't they? I'll give the website address again. Thank you for the reminder, Charlie. It's traprockpeace.org. So when there's so many people downloading, it can require a little patience to access that. traprockpeace.org.